few years back, well, let me back up. Good evening and welcome once again to Your Legal Rights on KALW 91.7 FM, San Francisco Bay Area. I'm your host, Jeff Hayden. A few years back, we heard talk of a changing landscape in the United States Supreme Court. Since then, we've seen explosive cases such as Dobbs versus Jackson Women's Health Organization, where a divided court overruled Roe versus Wade, sending the issue of abortion back to the states. We saw a broad immunity for the president for his or her actions, and a dialing back of the administrative state, and a strengthening of the Second Amendment. Many commentators felt this was but the beginning. We have been watching both that which has been decided and now what's to come. Tonight, as we did last year, we look down the barrel of the Supreme Court to see what's likely to come up during the next year. As always, you can call regarding any question on tonight's topic. We're talking about cases due to come before the United States Supreme Court. But you don't have to join us at the exact moment we may be in our conversation. Bear in mind that our attorney guest can't provide you precise legal advice without all the facts relating to a given case. We're happy to pass along legal principles to assist you in your decision-making. And perhaps most importantly, the legal guidance mightn't be the positions of their employers or their respective clients, but they're all here to help, to inform, to educate, and occasionally to entertain. Please join them. We're ready for your call. Our phone number, right here, 415-841-4134. Again, that's 415-841-4134. If you're outside of the local dialing area, call us toll-free at 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-8255. And to help us sort out just what is coming this term, having tried cases ranging from antitrust to wire fraud and from patent litigation to white-collar crime and murder, James Brosnahan defended John Philip Walker Lynn, the so-called Marin Taliban, an American captured by United States forces as an enemy combatant during the invasion of Afghanistan, and prosecuted Secretary of Defense Caspar Weinberger for the Iran-Contra affair. I could go on and on, but suffice it to say, Jim Brosnahan is a local legend. He's also the author of the book Justice at Trial, which I still maintain is a must-read. Ben Foyer is the chairman of the Complex Appellate Litigation Group, a boutique law firm specializes in high-stakes appeals with offices throughout California. Ben has been called one of the top appellate litigators in California, and his writing on appellate and constitutional law issues has been published in the Washington Post, the Los Angeles Times, and the San Francisco Chronicle. Ann Voights is a partner at Pillsbury Winthrop Shaw Pittman LLP. She previously served as a clerk for the Ninth Circuit and the United States Supreme Court, and formerly as a federal prosecutor. Ann has worked on cases before the United States Supreme Court and the California Supreme Court. And without further ado, Ann, Ben, Jim, welcome to Your Legal Rights.
Happy to be here.
Thanks so much.
You know, we've been talking about some of the cases that are pending, and some of them are more cases that are more interest to lawyers, but some of them are downright startling. Jim and I were talking before the show, and one of them, I think, that came up is a death penalty case, which really involves some scary prospects. And of course, with a grain of salt, because I practice criminal law, this one hits close to home. But who would like to talk about this case out of Oklahoma and what it stands for?
Well, I'll get it started, if that's okay. It is a startling case for this reason. There's leeway in the court system to have cases where the evidence is a bit thin. But in this case, Richard Eugene Gossip has benefited from the district attorney who was in charge of his case in that office. They confessed error. That's very unusual. And having confessed error, they now appear to follow through with that and to let gossip have a new trial or whatever is appropriate. And the basis for it was really very serious. They had one key witness. The one key witness had had psychiatric treatment and had been having that for quite a while, had serious mental issues. That was not disclosed. And that's a clear violation of the rights of Mr. Gossip. So the district attorney confessed error. But
well, let me interrupt you for just a moment.
Sure.
To our listeners, sounds like a mistake, and maybe they get some, the benefit of the doubt. But when you're talking error, we're talking about them holding back evidence from the defense that might have made a difference in the outcome of the case.
And that's one of the issues in the case. And the court has never been very good, in my opinion, in giving the benefit of the doubt to the defendant when they have to weigh the question whether it would make any difference. And as a trial lawyer, some of the material that they have approved over the years, I thought would have made a difference in any case. But in this case, the withholding of psychiatric testimony by a psychiatrist, that this key witness, and that I think that needs to be stressed, has resulted in this case. Now, the court took the case. Why does the court have to take the case? They took it, and it's on the calendar, and we can all watch that. I have noticed, and maybe I'm too suspicious, but this is a very conservative court, and I've noticed a couple of criminal cases in which the court kind of went out of its way to give the defendant a break. And this is, in my view, a little bit biased on the defense side. This is a case where they really should hold that under the circumstances, he's got to get some relief. They can decide what the relief is, but they've got to give him some relief. So we'll see. I know others on the panel want to talk about this also.
Well, I agree with you, Jim. This court, this conservative court, it likes to take cases where they are going to agree to a what might be considered a liberal outcome or a pro criminal defense, outcome.
Yeah.
Now, there are different reasons for that. One is certainly there are conservatives on the court who are at least skeptical of government and are going to take more anti-government positions than they used to, especially on criminal law and certain criminal rights. But it's also just because, you know, if they see a case where they agree the lower court got it wrong and it's, you know, going to be sort of a liberal outcome, then boy, that's one of the things they can point to say, look, we're not just a bunch of, you know, conservative hacks. We really like to think about these things and come out to the right answer, even if it's not the conservative one. I think it's also important in death penalty cases to keep in mind that you have six conservatives on the Supreme Court, all of whom are Catholic in one form or another, to varying degrees of Catholic. And Catholics are a conservative group that is fairly skeptical of the death penalty overall. Even conservative Catholics are somewhat skeptical of the death penalty. The court is happy, not happy is the right word, but the court is absolutely willing to let executions take place when they don't see something massively wrong, you know, with the decisions below. Many people who are executed have been on death row for a generation, given how slowly the legal system works with capital punishment appeals. But when they see one where they think they got it wrong and it's a death penalty case and they can reverse and say, look how neutral and balanced we are, and they can save a life, to put it in that sort of terminology, religious view, that I think that they're willing to take it. And I think you might be right. This one might be one where the court is going to come out to a reversal.
There was one aspect I want to add to it. This just occurred to me, but there's the executive and there's the judiciary. What does a courthouse look like on any given day? The DA is bringing cases. The DA is changing their mind. They're dismissing cases. That's within the powers of the executive. And here we have an authorized person, and I'm sure the court will deal with this in some way. And we have the judiciary passing upon whether this can be, in this case, a new trial could be granted. And it seems to me, maybe it's just a procedural hang-up that I have, but if the DA wants to do something with the case, I don't know why they can't.
Well, it's once you've got a conviction, that's the I think you've got the right issue, but I think you've got the analysis wrong. The DA can bring charges, can dismiss charges, but once you have a conviction, the court has now convicted somebody. A jury has convicted them. The judge has, entered a judgment. And at that point, you have a judicial ruling that the DA can't just come in and say, hey, yes, the courts have done something, but I don't want to do that anymore, so you got to let it go.
I think procedurally.
This came up with some of the Trump cases, as I recall. There was at least one person that there was a change in the Justice Department's position in terms of prosecution, as I recall. But they'd already been convicted, and the Justice Department simply changing their mind about whether someone should have been prosecuted in the first place is not enough on its own, without at least a judge agreeing that there's been a violation of the law.
Well, let me jump in for a minute. First, I want to bring Ann into the conversation. Ann, you've heard both Jim and Ben tell us that the glass is half full. Do you agree that the glass in this case is half full? Because I have another perspective that might be a little more onerous.
I tend to see it as half empty.
I do as well. Why do you see it as half empty?
I think I'm starting here and say, one, it's sort of frustrating. It's very rare that state or federal government will confess error in a case and say that something shouldn't have happened. The fact that this continues that there has been no meaningful relief for Mr. Glossop is deeply troubling. It is rare that these sorts of cases actually get traction in the courts, that there's actually recognition of some of the ways in which prosecutors can fall short.
Well, of course, for everybody like him, for 100 people like him, he may be the one that comes forward and where they actually admit to an error. Yes. And he actually has some traction. That's true. I'm not so sure I agree that the Supreme Court is going to be so magnanimous here. I see two pitfalls to worry about. One of them is, it's well established under U.S. Supreme Court precedent for generations now, under Brady versus Maryland and cases that have come since, that if the prosecution holds exculpatory evidence, they have to turn it over. If they know something that casts some doubt on guilt or maybe casts doubt on the severity, they have to share it, whether they want to or not. And that's been established law throughout all 50 states for a long, long time. And that might be something that they want to look at or possibly scale back on it. The other thing that I see that's a little onerous here is that the Oklahoma Court of Criminal Appeals held that the Post-Conviction Procedure Act prevents post-conviction relief. Well, what does all that mean for lay people? It means that the state has said, hey, we're done. You're done. And there's no relief available at the state. Normally, under federal law, before the U.S. Courts can look at this, they have to deem that the person has exhausted state law remedies. You've done everything you can in the state up to the highest level before you could go to federal court. Is there any chance that the U.S. Supreme Court will say, well, that may be a procedural nuance that you have to deal with, but no, you haven't exhausted state remedies, and they throw the case back and Oklahoma goes ahead and executes them?
I think that's possible, but I do think this is a terrible case to cut back on Brady, which, as your listeners understand, that Brady is a duty to disclose material. And very often that issue gets lost. It's not that strong in the case and all that. But to go back to my original point, when the district attorney confesses error, I think nobody would want to be at that execution.
Yeah, exactly.
I think this is my main point. I think that this court is, I hope, smart enough to not let this go forward. And if they're going to cut back Brady, they can do it. They can do it with dictum, I suppose, and give hints to people, other judges, that they're going to cut it back.
This is, I think you're totally right, Jim. And Jeff, I don't think that, don't have the concerns that you do, because this is the wrong case to do that, right? If the court wanted to take a case to pull back on Brady or to do other terrible things to the law involving capital punishment, there are cases which are much less sympathetic to the criminal defendant and much more sympathetic to the victim. And that's the case they would take to do that in. They would say, look, the court, you know, the Ninth Circuit, you know, granted habeas relief in this terrible case for this minor Brady violation. And they're letting this guy off the hook, and he's been on death row for 30 years, and it's cost $20 million to litigate all this. And the crazy Ninth Circuit let him off, and that's wrong. And so we need to pull it back, and we're changing the law in the process.
I agree.
But the court is very canny about the cases it takes, especially when it's going to do things that are, designed to get to a certain kind of outcome. And this is not that case.
Yep.
Well, we've been talking about Oklahoma. Maybe we should move east. Let's talk a little bit about Tennessee. There's a case out of Tennessee, Ben, that you brought up in your list about Tennessee Senate Bill 1 and what it does. Why don't I turn it over to you to bring that one up, talk about that.
Yeah. So this is probably the most, headline grabbing, I think, case probably on the court's docket so far. There will be many more headline grabbing cases this term, no doubt, especially with the election. But at the beginning of the term, I think this is probably the one that people are paying most attention for the political impacts. This is a law that many states in the South have passed banning transgender medical treatment, what is sometimes called gender affirming care, although I tend to find that to be a little bit of a strange terminology. But it is basically medical treatment to give hormones or other types of medical treatments to minors, juveniles, who have been diagnosed by a doctor as having a gender dysphoria type of issue, and therefore somebody whom at least some doctors would say would benefit from this kind of medical intervention. And this is a kind of law that we've seen in a lot of more conservative states, of course. Some courts have thrown them out, and largely depending on the political alignment of the courts, and some courts have approved them, again, largely depending on the political alignment of the courts. And there is now a split among the different federal circuits as to whether or not these types of laws violate the Constitution in some fashion, either a fundamental right to medical treatment or of your choice, or other types of constitutional protections, privacy, implied privacy rights, might be the basis for limiting a state's ability to ban certain medical procedures. The court has tried to avoid as much as possible transgender cases and related to that issue. I think partly that's because several years ago, this court, with its current makeup, or at least fairly close to it, found that it was a violation of federal law to fire employees who were transgender. That was a kind of discrimination under federal law based on gender. And I think neither the conservatives nor the liberals are confident in how a transgender case will come out in the court. And so I think the courts the Supreme Court has been loath to kind of take these. But now we do have a conflict among the circuits. The Ninth Circuit, for example, has held these types of laws to be unconstitutional. The 11th Circuit has held that they are constitutional, and several other circuits have gotten into the fray. And so the court really has to sort it out. I think it's fairly likely that the court will find these laws to be constitutional. And there are probably, there are a number of reasons for that. But the one that really, I think, strikes home is that for a fairly long time, states have had pretty broad authority to regulate medical practices within the state that the state believes to be either dangerous or not. And you saw this fairly recently, I mean, I guess not recently, maybe 10, 15 years ago, with laws in California that banned so-called gay conversion therapy. Gay conversion therapy is illegal in California. If you're a therapist, you cannot do this kind of therapy with people. There's actually an interesting challenge going up on based on the First Amendment to those laws currently, but that's not this case, and I suspect those will lose. But gay conversion therapy is unlawful, even though it's sort of a medical choice for minors that parents might make to think and doctors might make, I guess, in theory, to that they think is in the best interest of the child. And it's hard, pretty hard to see how this is different. That is, the state, in its infinite wisdom, whatever that wisdom may be, could decide that, look, this kind of medical procedure is dangerous and unlawful, and other kinds of medical procedures are not. It does somewhat dovetail into the abortion issue, because that, of course, is also a medical procedure, where some states have said that this procedure is unlawful and other states have said that it is lawful. And the Supreme Court has held that the Constitution doesn't say anything about that, that states can essentially regulate this or not as they see fit. And so I have a pretty hard time seeing how those abortion decisions are distinguishable from this sort of, you know, transgender youth medical treatment. And, you know, especially since, again, they're, you know, going back to how the court, the conservative court, likes to reach conclusions where they can also in some way say that this is a liberal outcome as well. A reversal here would throw into jeopardy state laws banning gay conversion therapy. So it's very probably easiest for the court in this situation to say, look, states can regulate medical procedures. And if you I don't know that they'll go so far as this, but if you want to live in a different state where those medical procedures are viable, you could do that if you want. But if you want to choose to live in Tennessee, this is not the kind of medical procedure you're going to be able to obtain in the state of Tennessee. And if the voters of Tennessee, you know, want to change that, they can elect people to change that. I think it probably also, comes into, you know, will come into the decision that there are really fairly emotionally sympathetic arguments on both sides of this. The parents of children who have been diagnosed with this kind of gender dysphoria and have doctors who say they need this kind of treatment, will be able to point to suicide rates among this group of people and other sort of heart-wrenching stories. And likewise, the other side will be able to point to stories of people who received hormone, these kinds of medical treatments, and then developed in ways that they later regretted and had no ability to undo, especially when they were given these treatments as children. So both sides have sort of emotionally sympathetic arguments, but I suspect the Supreme Court is going to uphold Tennessee's law in this situation.
Jim, how do you feel about this one?
Well, I'm not quite as sure that they will do that, although I bow to Ben on that. He would have a very good view of what might happen. For your listeners, there are four things really to keep in mind when you're watching this case. And I know you've got listeners out there that care quite a bit about the outcome of this case, is my guess, including parents. But the first one is this relates to minors. And I think that changes the tone of the case. It's not just a health matter. It's a minor matter, and that cuts two ways. First of all, the court could be seen as caring more about the law in this regard because it is a matter, a minor. On the other hand, as Ben has suggested, the parents, this is a parent's question. Suppose you have a young person, suppose somebody that's a minor, they're 16 maybe, but they're in that point of life where this might be appealing. The second question is, this is the Tennessee Department of Health, and there are allegations about the health effects of these operations, of which I have no opinion at all, not qualified to have an opinion, but the fact that it's a health issue, I think, supports the department in their way of doing it. An absolute ban of it is not a regulation. That's another factor to keep in mind. It's one thing to regulate. It's another thing to ban it entirely. And the burden, whether it be a legal burden or whether it be a medical burden, I think will be very interesting. And the next one is the question which I raise without answering the listeners' questions. There's something going on with this court and religion. In the question of abortion, there's strong arguments on both sides. They've been argued for years, and people have very strong opinions. I appreciate that. But the question is that there's a drive to bring as many cases of religion into the law at this time. There have been articles written about it by scholars, quantifying the number of cases pending and all of that. You have a suspicion that religion is playing a role, perhaps, in some of the thinking of some of the justices, but it's very hard to quantify it. But I think this case rises to it. Abortion has these arguments on both sides, but here is a case where someone is, perhaps with parental guidance, deciding who they are. And that has a quality, an edge to it, that makes me a little nervous. And the final point is, why did the court take this? I appreciate people want an answer, and there, as Ben said, there's a division in the circuits, and so they took it. But I'm a little less sure, and I'm on thin ice here, but I'm less sure what they're going to do. And I can think of some votes that certainly will uphold the complete ban of this on the part of the Tennessee Department of Health.
From my perspective, I see it a little differently. Many more moderate states don't like the idea that minors would make such decisions for themselves and would require parental consent. California is to one extreme, where we won't even let the school districts, under recently passed legislation, we can't let them tell the parents if the kids identify as a different gender, and they haven't told them.
They can't require, it's a little bit different. The law says they can't require teachers to tell. I think it's they, or they can't ban, they can't require teachers to tell the parents. The teachers can still tell the parents. It's not a ban.
But here under this in Tennessee, the parents aren't even in the discussion about these medical treatments and the like. We just decided they're icky. We don't want them. It's a really different thing socially. I don't know how the court's going to react. Dan, we have about a minute before we break. Do you have any feedback on this one?
Ann can't talk about it. She's got a conflict with her prior work, so I'm gonna interfere and speak for her on that regard and protect her from having to say anything.
That's two votes for you, Ben.
Yeah, two votes for me. I like that. But you know, I You know, I think you're certainly right, Jeff, that states like California have a very different approach to many of these issues. But California really isn't part of this, you know, this discussion and the way California is doing it. The only question is whether Tennessee's health department and its infinite wisdom and Tennessee's legislature in its infinite wisdom can decide that in the state of Tennessee, these kinds of procedures for minors are going to be banned. And that's why I suspect this is, the court is probably going to uphold the 11th Circuit and reverse the other circuits that have said no, right? I think there was an Idaho law that came before, the similar Idaho law that came before the Ninth Circuit, where the Ninth Circuit said this is unlawful. And I think that's probably going to get turned around.
You're listening to Your Legal Rights on KALW 91.7 FM, San Francisco Bay Area. And we'll be back right after this.
Support for KALW is provided by the Bar Association of San Francisco. If you live in San Francisco or Marin County, the Bar Association's lawyer referral service can arrange for you to meet with an attorney experienced in the area of law related to your situation. Call 415-989-1616 or visit sfbar.org for more information. And now, back to Jeff Hayden and Your Legal Rights.
Well, let's change direction. We've been talking Oklahoma. We've been talking Tennessee. You brought up that California is not part of that discussion, but you can't get around the next one for California because there's a case right out of here in San Francisco that looks at the city and county of San Francisco versus the EPA. Who wants to chat about that? And I want to bring you in on the conversation. Okay, Ben, I'll bring you in on the conversation.
Yeah, you know, I'm the only one on this panel who actually lives in the city of San Francisco. So I have a really personal stake in the outcome of this case. And then let's definitely have Ann lead off the case about the ghost gun.
For what it's worth, Ben, San Francisco controls the water for much of the Bay Area. So even those of us that live beyond the city limits are still going to feel the effects of this case.
Yeah, that's good. Yeah, good. That's right. You should feel it should be with me.
Misery loves company. Yes.
Yeah, that's exactly right. So this is a situation that's about the opposite kind of situation you would expect coming out of San Francisco. This is where a case that arises from the city of San Francisco dumping something like 180,000 gallons, maybe even more, of raw sewage into the surrounding waters. I don't know that it was right into the Golden Gate Bay, but into the surrounding waters around San Francisco. Just raw sewage right into the water. This is not environmentally friendly. You will be shocked to hear.
And this is San Francisco we're talking about.
This is San Francisco, believe it or not. You know, and the Environmental Protection Agency said, this is not environmentally friendly. And the EPA has a rule that basically says cities and governments and municipalities can't dump unreasonable or unsafe amounts of raw sewage into waters. It's a very fuzzy kind of standard, right? What is an unreasonable amount of raw sewage? I mean, if you were to ask me, it would be any raw sewage, but at least into my waters that I might drink from. But in reality, it's not. It's some unknown amount of raw sewage that is unreasonable and you can't dump into the water. And so the EPA brought a lawsuit against San Francisco. And San Francisco, again, this is one of those very weird situations where the city of San Francisco is fighting against the Environmental Protection Agency because San Francisco wants to do something that is not protective of the environment, particularly dumping this raw sewage. So San Francisco says, look, the EPA's rule is impossible to follow because we have no idea what an unreasonable amount of raw sewage is. And if we have to do what the EPA is telling us to do, which is that we can't dump this raw sewage that we've dumped, it's going to raise the sewage rates, the amount of money people in the city of San Francisco pay each year by 10 times, from $900 a year to $9,000 a year. And that alone would cause something like 10,000 citizens of San Francisco to be placed into poverty. So the economic, this is what the city says, of course. Is that true or not? Who knows? But the, that's what the city said in its brief. So there's, at least the city is saying there would be tremendous economic impacts to individual San Franciscans if we have to follow this rule. But moreover, this rule is impossible to follow because we don't know what the rule is. You haven't told us you can't dump 50 gallons or 500 gallons or 5,000 gallons. You've just said unreasonable amounts. And that makes it impossible for us to follow. It's like, where you're telling us that we've got to follow the law, but you're not going to tell us what the law is until we get it wrong. So that's San Francisco's argument. And it obviously matters a lot to people who live here and maybe everyone in the surrounding area, Jeff, who might have to pay very, increased, rates for their sewage service and water service. This is one of those times where so there's certainly going to be some members of the Supreme Court that are going to be chuckling at this case, because, you know, in a way they can't lose, right? On one hand, San Francisco gets to eat crow. On the other hand, the EPA gets to eat crow. So,
they can figure out a way for everyone to lose.
Yeah, exactly. It's a way that certain people can't lose, and in another way, everyone can lose. That's right. I think that the city of San Francisco might actually win out here, simply because the Supreme Court doesn't like very fuzzy regulations, and this Supreme Court doesn't really like the EPA. But they also don't seem to like San Francisco very much either.
I see Jim's been holding a finger up looking to get a word in. Let me bring him in.
Hold on one second. This goes back to a theme that I've mentioned in the last two cases we've talked about, which is the Supreme Court likes to find, this conservative Supreme Court likes to reach decisions that they can point to and say, look, here we came to a liberal outcome. Here we came to an outcome that even favored the city of San Francisco. We're not a bunch of conservative hacks. We're a very balanced and thoughtful group of people, and that may win the day here. Go ahead.
Well, they could say, here we are, you consider us conservatives, but we protected the environment here.
Exactly. That could also be what they say. Yeah.
They could pretty much go where they're going to and have a pretty good spin at the other end. Jim, you've been trying to get a word in.
Well, I wanted to disclose that I represented the city in a related case years ago. And if I tell you how long ago it was, you'll know how old I am. And I'm just trying to avoid that. And the issue was $1.3 billion to keep the waste from going into the bay. The government had allotted the money, and they decided then they didn't want to give the money, but they wanted the city to do it. I'm certainly count myself as an environmentalist. I've been on some boards that dealt with all that. But there is another side of the issue, which is the cost. And in one case, for example, America was insisting that a certain African country do a certain thing, and it was half their net worth for a year. So the question here is whether the EPA has to tell exactly how much, what the number is, basically, that they're regulated by. Well, that has a deep jurisprudential justification. The citizen is supposed to know what they're supposed to do, void for vagueness if it's not there. So here we are with a problem, but the law is already now that EPA is supposed to say how much you're allowed to do. They have to be specific, and that they were not in this case. So I agree with Ben that I think what they're going to do is find that that's part of the law that, as Ben, I think, suggested, it's a happy day for the court. San Francisco is violating the whole idea that every citizen swears to in San Francisco about nature and so forth and preserving the universe. But the EPA, and I want to emphasize this, if there's a basic principle in this on this court, Now, with the six justices, there's much too much regulation, and they're figuring out every day what they can chastise, what they can cut back, and what they can show is, in their view, a serious problem.
Let me switch. I'd like to switch gears a little bit. One of the things that we've been talking about with the Supreme Court over the last couple of years is Second Amendment jurisprudence. We saw first a pretty big expansion of gun rights. Last year, we saw some outer limits of where they might have said, you know, or actually they did say, well, if the state wants to regulate it here, that part's okay. And now it looks like there's a case involving ghost guns. Anne, do you want to jump on this?
Yeah, happy to. So this is a case about ghost guns, who, for your listeners who don't know, those are just firearms that don't have serial numbers that, at least according to the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, Firearms says pretty much anybody can put them together with parts that you can get through a kit online or through the mail. And the problem is that they don't have serial numbers that are normally used by law enforcement to track guns. So in 2022, a federal rule was promulgated that tried to regulate them. And the ATF defended it, saying, look, this is an urgent public safety and law enforcement crisis. It's an exponential increase in ghost guns. And at least their position has been that this isn't a ban. This is just an attempt to sort of make sure that they're regulated the same way as other commercial gun sales are. This was challenged by people who said, look, in fact, this isn't this. The federal government hadn't previously required a license if you were going to build a gun for your private use. And they said, it's not really a problem. Federal laws apply to most of the firearms produced in the country, and ghost guns aren't actually a substantial source of firearms for criminals. All of this happens sort of against the background of the Gun Control Act, which requires manufacturers and dealers to get a federal license. They have to keep records, and they have to conduct background checks, and they have to have, for manufacturers, they have to put serial numbers on guns. And while there's been an increase in the number of ghost guns, because they can be bought online, you don't have to present ID, you don't have to go through the background check that federally licensed dealers normally have to make you go through, and you can buy them anonymously with cryptocurrency or a prepaid debit card. So ATF issued this rule to sort of say, look, these requirements also apply to ghost guns. The same ones that apply to ordinary guns should apply here too. And it tried to define what a firearm is to include things that can be sort of readily completed or converted to function as like the frame or receiver of a gun. Challengers brought suit in Texas, one of the popular states if you are bringing a challenge to gun regulations. And the district court agreed and barred the ATF from enforcing the rule anywhere in the United States. The Supreme Court actually did grant the Biden administration's request to enforce the rule while it was appealed. The Fifth Circuit ultimately upheld the district court's decision, and that led the Biden administration to come to the Supreme Court and say, look, we need you to decide this issue. Are ghost gun parts and kits, are they firearms that are actually regulated under the act? And is this bill actually, or is this rule something that is actually proper and within the ATF's power? In terms of what's actually disputed, pretty much everything. There are even disputes as to what it means to sort of readily put a kit together and how hard it is, right? Is it like an IKEA piece of furniture where you think, oh, look, this is going to be really straightforward, and then 20 hours later, you still don't have a bunk bed or a functional gun? So I'm curious, Ben and Jim and Jeff, you too, where you think that this is going to be, where this is going to come out.
I had a couple of points to add to what you said, and I agree with what you said. These are ghost guns. They can be constructed in 20 minutes. You buy a kit outside of all of the factors, Anne, that you mentioned. Outside,
you can 3D print them, too.
Outside, what?
You can 3D print them at home.
Yeah.
You don't even need to buy a kit.
Yeah. And all the things that regulate guns now and are still there are there. But there were four justices that voted to take this case. And this is an important case. There's no reason not to take it. But they were Thomas, Alito, Gorsuch, and Kavanaugh. Now, first of all, somebody needs to get both Barrett and Roberts to join them on this case. And I would say, normally, I would say, well, they're not going to do that. I mean, that's dangerous. But here's the background. I'll be very brief because I want to hear from Ben. Roberts and Kavanaugh in the first gun case, and it's two or more years ago, said, we're not saying there'll be no regulation. But the only case where they allowed regulation was a kind of maniac husband who was in the practice of beating his wife, and he had a gun, and he had been convicted of some things. It was a very narrow case. The case on the arming of rifles to make them into machine guns was a case that was embarrassing to the court. You know why? Because the definition of a machine gun, which has been with the American people all the way back to when I was a federal prosecutor, is geared to the number of shots that you can shoot in a course of a minute. And there's an overlap between an enhanced rifle and a machine gun. The numbers overlap. Those rifles are a machine gun when they're enhanced. And yet, the conservatives said, now, those rifles are protected. So there's an element of, I want to put it discreetly, of over-enthusiasm for the non-regulation of guns in this country at a time when the public opinions are way on the other side. And that's worth watching in this case.
Yeah, I agree completely with Jim that there is a movement within the conservative judiciary for a maximalist interpretation of the Second Amendment. And I don't really understand where it's coming from. It's purely within the judiciary. It's not really an issue of political support, even by many members, many people on the right. And it's nonsensical. One of the worst Supreme Court decisions I have ever read was the opinion in the Bruin case, where the court adopted this purely imaginary judicial idea that the Second Amendment should be interpreted, in line with historical traditions involving gun regulation, which, of course, they did that because there are very few historical traditions involving gun regulation, because the explosion in guns is fairly recent. The court's been working to pull that back, I think, because they realized it's a totally unworkable standard. I mean, it's really one of the worst decisions possibly in Supreme Court history, because it's just so badly reasoned. What the court's gonna, I am hopeful on this ghost gun question that the court is, that there's some sort of realism here on the court. And I think there is. And I think we saw that last term with the case involving whether guns can be taken away from people who are found to have committed domestic violence, where the court said, yes, you can take those guns away. They want people, well, some members of the court want everyone to have guns coming out of their ears, right? Clarence Thomas thinks everyone should be packing an AK-47, every day when they go to work and school. But he's nuts. So he's more conservative than something like 98% of the U.S. population. I think among the saner members of the Supreme Court, at least on this issue, I think there's a recognition that, there is a problem with everybody having guns. And while, you do need to have we do need to respect the Second Amendment, and that people do at least at a basic level have to be able to have a right to have a gun and perhaps carry it with them when they go out for their safety. We don't want a society in which there are just guns everywhere with no oversight. Nobody knows what the guns are. There's no way to trace them. And that, criminals are just going to kill lots of people, and that there'd be no way to do anything about it or even prosecute those people. I'm hopeful But I think that there's a majority, maybe just a 5-justice majority, hopefully maybe even a 6-justice majority. But I think there's a majority of the Supreme Court who recognizes that reality. The gun stuff is crazy, and the jurisprudence is the Bruin case is fairly incoherent and impossible to apply in any sort of cogent fashion. So it is somewhat hard to predict what the court will do when it comes to guns. But I think this one might be getting reversed.
So one of the things that I have learned is a good idea, a good way of telegraphing where the court might be going. It's not just the cases that are coming down the pipeline, the ones that we're going to hear about, but also some of the cases they chose to ignore and not take up. And some of the ones this year they denied are rather interesting. One of the denied petitions was actually from Robert F. Kennedy Jr., who wanted to control whether New York listed him on the ballot. Who'd like to chat about that a little bit?
Well, I can talk about it if no one else wants to. This is part of RFK's, scheme to try to put himself on the ballot in states where he thinks he can help Donald Trump and take himself off the ballot in states where he thinks he can hurt Donald Trump. There's another case also involving Jill Stein, where she's sort of doing the same thing. There's a theory out there that she's sort of, a Putin, she's kind of on the, I don't know about on the payroll of Putin, but that she's certainly sympathetic to Putin's desires, which is obviously to get Donald Trump back in office. And because she refused to criticize Putin in any way in some interview. And I don't know if that's true, but that's certainly one of the theories out there. But the Supreme Court refused to get involved, to grant a petition by RFK, where he wanted to be forced to be, I think, on the New York ballot because maybe he could draw enough votes from Kamala Harris to let Trump win in some way, and refused to consider a petition of Jill Stein to get on the Nevada ballot for the same reason, really. I mean, she doesn't expect to win. She just wants to draw votes, probably, it seems, from Kamala Harris in order to help Trump win. And the court didn't want to get involved in either of those requests. And I think that certainly those requests probably neither had tremendous merit on their face. But, I think the court wants to stay out of the election as much as it possibly can. Every time the court gets involved in anything Trump related, it's a disaster. If they may well have to decide this election like they did in 2000 in terms of recounts and certification and all of the kind of shenanigans that are gonna occur, and if they have to do it, they'll do it. But boy, if they could avoid doing it, they would love to avoid doing it. They do not want to be deciding the president of the United States.
And with some of the contentious activities from both sides, that could end up happening in any one of a number of scenarios. We do have a caller on the line. I'd like to turn it over to Cal from Monterey. Cal, you're on the air. Welcome to Your Legal Rights.
Hi. I think it's important that when Kamala wins, that we put as many new justices so we can have 15 justices and make infanticide, especially if babies over, already out of the womb, make that legal. That should be just like a drive-by thing, like Jack in the Box, and just murder as many babies as possible. Signed, every Democrat ever. That's all we care about. Okay, bye.
Hey, on the one hand, our caller was being kind of facetious, but I don't know if Cal knows about the Wyden bill. I don't think I have personal views about whether the Wyden bill is a good idea or whether it's going anywhere. But Jim, why don't you tell us what that is?
Well, the bill was introduced 6 days ago, and it calls for a court of 15 members. And it does other things which are less controversial, like a code of ethics which I favor, having been in federal courts my whole career. I think there are arguments against this, but I think Supreme Court should be governed by the same ethics that all the other federal judges are governed by. And there's good reason for that. We don't have the time for that. On the question of the size, I think it's a mistake. This may be just a comment by an older person. I know it's so frustrating, but things can happen that change people. And it wouldn't surprise me over the next 3 or 4 years, depending on who's the president, what the country is like, that one or two of the conservatives would become more open-minded. That happened after FDR tried to stack the court, which is very unpopular. It was one of the worst things he tried to do. And when he tried it and he failed, some of those judges decided they were going to retire and so forth and so on. And I know it's not a courageous view, but I'd rather wait and see what happens with the court on the number.
I'm not sure the history totally supports the idea that FDR's court stacking would have failed had the justices not switched their positions on some of the economic issues, for example, the minimum wage and child labor laws that were before the court at that time. There was a switch in justices. You saw then a number of justices retired, and then FDR appointed the justices he wanted and got the legislation he wanted. But he might well, had that not occurred, there's a fairly decent historical view that he might have gotten his court packing. Whether it's a good idea or not, I don't know.
I just want to say don't think so.
Yeah. The Wyden bill would increase the number of judges to justices on the Supreme Court to 15. There are other bills to put in term limits, which might make a little bit more sense. Another strange thing that the Wyden bill does, which hasn't gotten a lot of attention, is that it increases to 2/3 the number of justices required to overturn an act of Congress. Now, I'm not sure that a congressional law bill can do that. I'm not sure that Congress can actually control the courts, you know, what number of justices counts as a sufficient majority for the court to reverse. The Constitution says that Congress can regulate the courts subject to it says that the courts should be created subject to exceptions and regulations.
Ben, I've got a caller calling in. We have less than a minute, so I'm going to try to put Mike through. Mike from Oakland, you're on the air, but your time is quite short.
Okay, yes. My question is, if it comes to the Supreme Court again, does Biden now have the authority to block the Supreme Court's giving it to Trump again, like he gave it to, like they gave it to in 2016?
I'm not sure that the Supreme Court gave the election to Trump in 2016. For better or worse, Trump seemed to win the election in 2016.
They did give the court, though, in 2012, if I have my year correct.
Well, they certainly made the decision
they
in 2000.
In.
Right,
here's what they did. Okay, they stepped in. There was counts. There were recounts. It was close. They stepped in. They stopped it. And we got a Republican president.
That was 2000.
That was the history of what the court did.
Yeah, that was 2000. That was Bush v. Gore. And I think the court was so burned by that, they are extremely hesitant to do that again. We will see, right? I mean, it's a conservative group of people, folks on the court. For the most part, though, I think most of the Trump judges would be happy not to have Trump again, that the conservative project can probably succeed more effectively with somebody other than Trump.
And with that, we are out of time, but I would like to thank Mike for calling in, and especially thanks to my guests. You've been listening to Your Legal Rights on KALW 91.7 FM, San Francisco Bay Area. Tonight, we've been looking ahead a new docket of cases pending at a newly reconstituted United States Supreme Court. Our guests have been legendary trial lawyer James Brosnahan, the author of Justice at Trial, and appellate lawyers extraordinaire Ann Voigt from Pillsbury Winthrop Shaw Pittman LLP, and Ben Foyer, chairman of the Complex Appellate Litigation Group. Please join Your Legal Rights again next week, Wednesday at 6, when we will look at anti-Semitism and your workplace. A big thanks to tonight's guest, and especially to all of you for joining us. And at the controls, Joanne Marr. I'm Jeff Hayden. Good night. Stay safe and zealously guard your legal rights.